This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the National Museum of Australia. My name's Martha Sear. I'm a senior curator in the People and the Environment team here at the museum, and I'm one of the many people who has put together the Spirited Australia's Horse Story exhibition. And it's my job today to tell you a bit about what happened behind the scenes, the making of Spirited. How many people have seen the show yet? Hands up, good stuff. I think it's really fair to say that Australia just wouldn't be the same without horses. For more than 200 years, they've set the rhythm of everyday life here. They've helped us get around, they've helped us do almost everything. And I guess Spirited tells the grand and complex story of dependence, hard work, passion and affection that is Australia's horse story. The show begins with the arrival of horses in Australia in 1788 and traces how they've shaped Australian life in different kinds of places. The pastoral station, the road, the farm, the city, the battlefield, the rangelands, the track and the competition arena. And what I'd like to do today, I guess, is to take you behind the scenes of the museum to show you how we put a show like this put together. Before I get really stuck into that story, I just want to let you know that this talk is the first of a series of three talks that give you insights into the stories behind the exhibition. The next one's coming up about a month from today, which looks at, and it looks at the history of horse welfare in Australia. And in November, we have we're very, very delighted to have Professor Paul McGreevy with us, who's one of Australia's sort of leading equitation scientists, and he'll be talking to us about how horses learn, really. So mark those in your diary. Today, what I really want to do is talk to you about the making of the exhibition itself and share some of the stories that lie behind the exhibits that you've seen or are about to see. Before I get started, though, I really want to hear what you most want to hear about, because I know what the stories are that interest me and the rest of the team, but I just wanted to take a few minutes to see if there was anything in particular you wanted me to tell you about or tell you more about. Just put your hand up if you've got an idea, and I can add it to my list.
No.
G'day.
I'm Shirley Troy, and I come from a horsey family. I'm not a horse person myself.
Yeah.
I just want to know who inspired exhibition? Where did it all start?
Yeah, where did it come from?
Yes.
Sure, no worries. Someone else there?
Thank you. Christine Clark, I just wanted to find out a bit more about those the extra forensic on Farlap
was discovered. Oh, yes, no worries. Okay, sure, Farlap. Add that to my list. Heidi?
My favourite's the milk carriage.
Yeah.
I think that's a heck of a story.
Yep, no worries. I can do that. Milk wagon. Anything else? Oh, yes.
Hi.
Hello.
High Country Brumbies.
Oh, yep, the Brumby side of things. Cool. Terrific. Any other burning questions? Oh, here we go, down the front. Sorry.
I wonder how many other resources are around the country still that could highlight this sort of theme that you haven't yet explored and might be useful for future consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Terrific. So other resources around the country. Terrific. Okay. Well, I'll remember to come back to those if I... Just give me a prompt if I forget. I'm not alone here today in terms of the people who've worked on the exhibition. There's many of them in the audience. In terms of the curatorial side of things, Kirsten Wayner, my colleague over there, worked on the project, and Jen Wilson, just there. So sometimes I'm telling their stories. They may jump in and provide an even better version of the story. Or they may not. They may remain silent. I think I've already talked to you guys about this. There's an opportunity, I guess, to explore additional content. A lot of the things I'm talking about, we've developed a website that has some of the like more images and additional stories and stuff like that. So a lot of you, I've already shown you this, where to point your internet browser. But if you haven't done it already, that's the address. If you've got your smartphone or your tablet, then have a look there. And feel free to browse those while I'm talking. I'm an obsessive internet browser. I will not be in the slightest bit offended if you're all looking down and going like this. That is totally fine with me. So to get started, I guess to answer your question, where did the inspiration for this exhibition come from? The idea for the exhibition really came from a bunch of passionate horse people within the museum. Carol Cooper, Kirsten Wayner and Matthew Higgins. And they knew our collections really well, and they knew that the horse story was well represented within the National Historical Collection. And they also had a sense that the time had come to recognise the role that horses have played in Australian history. And so I guess the conjunction of a bunch of people who were really passionate about the horse, a really rich collection resource for us to draw on, really drove the exhibition through the exhibition approvals process. It was a nice piece of serendipity that it was launched in the year of the horse, but it was really the passion of those people for the horse that got it off and started. And a curatorial team then set to work to develop the content for the show, and I just want to name those curators who've worked on it. It's a big team that pulled that giant exhibition wool wagon along for the course of its life. So Kirsten, myself, Jen, Nicole McLennan, Laura Breen, Cheryl Crilly, Jennifer Moncrief and Michaela Harkin. So it takes a big group of people in the curatorial team to put a show together. And then we've been joined over the course of the exhibition's journey by hundreds more people inside the museum and beyond the museum who've collaborated together to produce the exhibition that you can see now. So we all started working on Spirited about 2 years ago, and we began by trying to learn about our horse history, reading all the major books that had been written, and there are a lot of really interesting books. Visiting communities around Australia to learn more about horse sports and activities and horse collections. And that's where I might answer that question about resources out there, because the thing is that I guess the horse is such a big part of our collection. It's also a big part of almost all other collections in Australia. So if any rural or regional museum you walk into, the particular facet of horse history that's most important there, whether it was ploughing and working the land or stock work, will be really well represented. And so you're absolutely right. Beyond these walls are thousands and thousands more objects that tell Australia's horse history, and it would be fantastic if there was some impetus to sort of start recognising the horse's role more precisely in those collections. If it was inspired by this, we'd be thrilled to bits. So what we were trying to do was really build up a sense of how we might fit what was an incredibly rich history and a really rich range of collection materials into that exhibition space, which seems gigantic but is really quite small. I'm going to try and focus today on the stories of the objects because I find them really compelling, and so I'll sort of take you through the journeys of some of those objects from the from wherever they were living through to their shining stardom in the temporary gallery at the moment. So I guess every exhibition begins with research into the objects that we might be able to feature, and we began by doing a survey of the museum's own collections, and Nicole McLennan really kicked that off. And what she found was that there were more than 5,500 objects just in our collection that had a horse connection, whether they were strengths in our collection, so we're really strong in things like flat racing, horse-drawn vehicles, farm machinery, saddlery and blacksmithing, Central Australian stockwork. These were areas the museum had been working on for many years, and so we had strong collections there. But we also found that there were some areas of gaps, weaknesses that were in the collection And we decided to set about trying to fill them. And some of those were things like we didn't have really strong collections around horse health and welfare. We didn't have strong collections around equestrian sports or about the horse in urban areas. So we kind of set our minds to both understanding our own collection a bit better and trying to selectively add to it to make the story complete. So let me take you through a few examples of how we brought these. We sort of had to go out and muster up all the objects, sort of get on our own saddles and find them. And the first and most unusual place that we found them, and this is really a striking new development for us, is that we found them on eBay and Gumtree. So for those of you who like a bit of eBay shopping, you can always... you can pick up a nice pair of shoes, or you can also pick up some really lovely pieces of Australian heritage. like quite a bit of historical material is now popping up on eBay, and it's a new part of the curator's job to keep scanning across eBay, looking for things. I guess we had a run of things we were looking for all the time about horse-drawn vehicles and horse this and horse that. There were lots of strange things we didn't actually get, carousel horses and... But there were these just some treasures that we turned up that we were thrilled about, and I'll just run you through a few of those. I have to say Nicole McLennan was really the heroine of this search. She became known as the Queen of eBay because she would spend her evenings sitting at home watching the TV and just flicking through to see what had popped up. And there were numerous times that she spotted something at like 9 o'clock at night. She'd already sort of sent them an email saying, "Can you put this on hold, Boris?" And by the morning, we had yet another object to add to the National Historical Collection. Anyway, we'll start with the Wykes horse trough. Just quickly, a good example of where Nicole, scanning through eBay, found this family from central New South Wales. Norwood is near Wellington. They'd used horses on the property from the 1850s until the 1990s, but... their chaff shed had fallen down. It just sort of suffered a few too many windstorms and rainstorms, and it had fallen down. And the family recognised that these two troughs, which had been made from fallen trees, or I guess felled trees on the property and then hollowed out to enable the mostly draft horses on the property, which numbered between 12 and 20 animals in the period the family were working them, hollowed them out to make them into feed troughs. They were just so beautiful. I mean, I'd seen feed troughs in rural museum collections, but we knew we didn't have one in our collection. And they were just such a sort of stunning example of the way in which the local environment was sort of turned to practical purposes. We had two to choose from. We knew from eBay. So Jen and Nicole jumped in the car and drove over to the property to take a look, and in the end they chose the one on the left. It's about four and a half metres long, 4.3, says Jen. And of course, while they were there, they were not only able to choose which one we should bring into the collection, but also to document the family's stories and also document where they had been sitting. So you can see here they were able to take photographs of the footings where the troughs had sat during the course of their useful life. And so we were very enamoured of this object. We convinced everyone else in the museum that we should get it. Then the work began of loading it into the museum. I think the family may have helped us with their tractor at their end, but we had to have Patrick and his amazing forklift to bring it in. So it came in on a truck. And Patrick put the forklift to work to drop it in, and then we put it on the scale. So 687.5 kilos, which we then needed to inspect. Here's Nicole and... is it Debbie? Donna, of course it is. What a dope I am. And Donna looking at it, the expressions on their faces sort of say it all. We really wanted to maintain a lot of this residue inside because it had chaff in it. You know, it spoke to what they'd been used for. But Donna's job is to get these objects. She does pest and hazard work amongst her many other important jobs. And so her job is to make sure that the little creepy crawlies that come into the museum with our objects don't creep and crawl into the rest of the collection. So At that moment, I think Donna's thinking, I've got to get this into the freezer. So her job and Patrick's job was to get this very heavy object into the freezer and freeze it, which kills all of the larvae and active pests, and then we could display it in the exhibition. And here it is. So if you've seen the show, you know that the trough takes pride of place at the end of the farm module. And this is members of the Wykes family who visit us for the opening. So that's, an example of one of our more splendid eBay purchases. We do. We have to freeze lots of massive things. Vehicles, cars, anything big that you can imagine. Big bits of ironwork, and anything could have a little creepy crawly inside. So here's another one of our treasures. This is one where we saw something beautiful where maybe others may have seen something scary. Nicole, again, another evening spent in front of eBay, turned up this horse-drawn milk cart. Now, the advertisement indicated that it was from Ty's, the Lincoln Park Dairy in Essendon. And thanks to our friends at the National Library and Trove, so the newspaper resource there, she could immediately jump on and do a newspaper search for this family and this dairy, and discovered within a minute or two that we knew that there was going to be a great story behind this object. It had been in use from the 40s to 1987, and so it spoke to a really astonishing sort of survival of the horse as a working animal in inner city parts of Melbourne. And we were able to see beyond the initial photograph. This is the photograph from eBay. The wagon had been purchased by a man named Mr. Buckles from the Ties when the dairy closed, and he had taken it apart with a view to restoring it. You know, he has a passion for restoring vehicles like this, and so he understood its heritage significance, and he was intending to spend, you know, his time to put this vehicle back together and care for it. Unfortunately, health problems meant he wasn't able to do that, and that's why he chose to put it up for sale. So it was in parts, essentially the framework was fine and the parts had been stored well, so it was all in good shape. Laura Breen and members of registration and conservation went down and had a look at it, and our colleagues, with great courage, agreed that it could be put back together, and they undertook to do that piece of work. Here's another shot of it when they went and visited it for the first time. And here is it. It is in its glory days. Really, once it arrived at the museum, the work really began. Firstly, for Laura, who made contacts with a bunch of astonishingly fabulously helpful people at the Essendon Historical Society, who connected us with people in the community who knew about the cart. We found Mr. Dingle, who'd been an apprentice to the coach builder. We found residents who remembered it, and then we found the Thai family themselves. So it's a really great example of collaborating with a local historical society to find amazing new information about our heritage. And then, I guess, conservation had to begin the work of putting the cart back together. First, they had to work on... Here's Conway and the milk bottles. First, they had to do a bunch of work... analysing the paint, cleaning the object, and then beginning to look at how to take those paint flakes, which had curled up. You know, the paint had become very dry, very brittle. It was coming loose from the surface upon which it had been applied. And so they had to go through this absolutely painstaking job of relaxing the tiny, tiny fragments of paint, up to sort of down to 1 millimetre sort of width pieces, and then using steam, so moisture, to soften the pieces of paint, and then heat to apply them. So if you look at that corner down here, this picture here, you can see one of the conservators who's softened the paint with some steam and then is using a heated spatula to connect the flake of paint with the wood using a small sliver of specially cut adhesive material. So that's the amount of work they had to do for every flake that they needed to put back on. They also did a lot of cleaning, and that cleaning revealed some rather amazing hidden paintwork. So when they began the object, it's on the left, the back top of the vehicle looked like just a simple paint, yellow paint surface. But when Karen began doing that painstaking work of brush vacuuming and steam cleaning, a little piece of script started to appear. And she kept working and kept working. And, of course, these guys are people who've trained to work with paintings. You know, their job is to work at the National Gallery and, you know, look after a Van Gogh. We were asking them here to work on something that we think is just as significant, just as yellow, but in entirely new kinds of circumstances. And underneath was this amazing script which said, for pure pasteurised milk. If you are visiting the show again, make sure you pop around the back of the cart and you can actually see that there. And that spoke to a really important part of the vehicle's history, because this style of cart had come into usage in Victoria because of new rules and regulations around the health and safety of milk, which involved pasteurisation but also bottling and things like that. You needed a big, heavy cart to carry bottles of pasteurised milk around. So that was a really amazing find. Not long after Nicole found the milk wagon, she also found this is some more of the paint restoration of the wagon, and there it is in all its beautifulness. And there's Conway at the opening. So we were sort of very excited to have the family that had been associated with the vehicle here. And that's one of the great things about the exhibitions, about making an exhibition, is that you can work with collections that are held in great regard by individuals in a community or by a community like the Essendon community, and bring their stories to light to the rest of us. So as I say, Nicole didn't stop there. Pretty shortly afterwards, she found this amazing bakery cart for sale. That was the point where our colleagues started to say, how many more flaky paint horse-drawn vehicles can we have in the National Historic Collection? And we, no. Milk and bread are very different. And this is a very different kind of cart. This cart is much more in the style of an early 20th century delivery vehicle, a lighter horse pulling a single horse pulling a much older style of cart. But it was in use from the 1930s to the 1960s in Newcastle. This one was sold to us by, it was owned by an Office Works, an office supply company in Newcastle, and it had been part of their Christmas decorations. As you can see, it was in their office supply warehouse. So objects come to us from all sorts of interesting places. We had to transport it, so here's the cart arriving from the back of a truck at the store. And here it is. Here's a similar type of cart in use in its glory days. And I guess we intended to bring it back as far as we could. We weren't aiming here to completely restore the vehicle. The paintwork is historically significant in itself, so our goal was to stabilise it and ensure that it would was clean and looked great, but that it also wasn't going to flake off. So we weren't going to lose any of that heritage significance. Again, another example of painstaking, diligent, patient work from the conservation team, who had to do the same kind of work, sticking there's Karen looking like a Ghostbuster. The same kind of meticulous work, testing and gluing things back on, which has meant that we now have a beautifully preserved bakery cart from Newcastle. So I guess these were objects that we were looking to sort of bring into the museum because we had a lack. Another area where we didn't have much strength was around the health story. And so we went out looking for objects about particularly equine influenza, which had brought the Australian racing industry to a standstill in 2007. We knew of this rather amazing story about the cancelled Birdsville races. So in 2007, the races were cancelled because of the quarantine travel restrictions that were placed around horses because of equine flu. And so the people of Birdsville came up with toy horse racing to meet the needs of the thousands of people who were expecting a real horse race. So we called the local Birdsville pub owner and said, you know, did any of the horses from that race, do they survive? And she said, yeah, sure, they're on the side of the pub, sticking up on the wall of the pub. Luckily for us, one of our curators in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program, Barbara Paulson, was visiting Birdsville just that same time. And she was able to stop off at the pub and take a snap of the three horses who were in the running to join the National Historical Collection. We picked the fabulous Jackson. And here he is, getting ready to race on that day. And here he is today. He's found his forever home with us at the Mitchell store. There's a story of Jackson online, if you want to follow up, on the People and the Environment blog, which I can heartily recommend to you. As far as other interesting efforts to try and get objects for the exhibition, we've got Kirsten's visit to the Quilty, which I'll just touch on. Kirsten and Jason, one of our photographers, bravely stepped forward to cover the Quilty, so that Australia's major endurance ride, where competitors cover 100 miles in 24 hours, and which has the rather remarkable start time of midnight. So, Kirsten, how many hours sleep did you get that night? None at all. So they had to work pretty much 2 days straight to document the race from start to finish, but also all the preparation and then all of the sort of wash-up, the things that went on after the race. And what we got out of that was not only a remarkable set of photographs, which you can find if you scroll through the page that I've sent you to, you'll find a suite of those images that show you the race from start to finish. But also Kirsten was able to acquire the complete kit that Brooke Sample, who's the rider there in the number one, he kindly agreed to take all of the gear that he had on that day and put it in a bag for the museum, starting with the top of his head all the way down to his boots and his watch and everything, his skin. So he's like a cricketer with his pressure suit on. And as well as that, the equipment that Brooke Lee Excalibur was wearing, the horse was wearing. So with that, Kirsten acquired like a most an unbelievable suite of objects to help us tell the story of endurance in Australia. And if you've seen the exhibition, you'll see how stunning they are and how remarkable a job conservation have done to make Brooke look rather lifelike. Then Jen bravely stepped forward to explore camp drafting and rodeo sports at the Warwick Rodeo and Camp Draft. And again, Jason put his body to the test, straddling the chute and getting under the competitors. He just took another suite of incredible photographs, which are also available through that website that I showed you. And Jen had the job of chasing cowboys, didn't you? Trying to convince them to lend us objects for the exhibition. So particularly in the sporting area, so many people in the equestrian sports, they're either still using their equipment or it really means so much to them they don't want to part with it, they don't want to donate it to the museum. So we were looking there at supplementing the exhibition with loans. And so Jen had to kind of talk to them about lending us their saddles, you know, their lucky saddle. They didn't necessarily want to give up because it was the one that made sure that they won. It's thanks to Jen that really when you stand there and you look at that that open range exhibit with all those amazing trophies and the gear, it's because really Jen had built up a rapport, a trusting relationship with that community. And going out and spending time with people is really the only way to do that. You know, an exhibition like this has hundreds of relationships woven into it, and each of those is important, and each of those we want to be respectful about and want to spend time nurturing. So we're grateful to all those communities for stepping up. We also had some serendipitous opportunities. It seems like when you start an exhibition on a particular subject that immediately objects start popping up that suddenly seem interesting. We were offered this powder horn, which has a kangaroo coursing scene on it, from a dealer in New York, a tribal art dealer in New York, who'd actually got it from the estate of a Marine Corps soldier who'd picked it up in the Pacific when he was in the Pacific during World War II. And this is an example of where a curator's research skills or took an object from one level to another. So we already knew it was fantastic because it had a horse on it, naturally. But Nicole went that step further and was able, by putting together the puzzle of researching the heraldry of the coat of arms on the top. By doing that, she was able to narrow the date of the carving to a very small date range in the 1830s. And then she spent a lot of time staring at that John Kelly E28P and had the brilliant inspiration that John had been interrupted in his carving, and that 28, that P was probably not a P but an R, that he was likely to be a soldier, and that she should start looking through the musters for the 28th Regiment, which came to Australia in the 1830s. And by doing that, she found two men named John Kelly who were in Australia with the 28th Regiment in the 1830s. So we've effectively been able to pin this object down to one of two men, thanks to her imaginative leap and thanks to her amazing genealogical research. I'm running out of time, so I'd better whiz through a few things here. Some of you will have met the Quail Saddlery horse in the exhibition. It stood and displayed the wares of Quail Saddlery in Cooma, probably from the 1880s through until the 1970s. The museum has a collection of many, many thousands of tools from the Quail Saddlery, and Nicole's work, again, lay in understanding how each of them was used and making a selection of them for the show. A major piece of work for conservation was to take the display horse, which got christened Winnie, from this state to the state that you can see it in the show. Interestingly, again, this is a sort of amazing piece of paintings conservation. Winnie is effectively a three-dimensional painting. Lying underneath is a wooden form, and over that form is stretched pieces of canvas. So Chloe, who did the work, and you can see her here, had to apply those same principles that you would apply to conserving a painting, but to a three-dimensional form. Excuse me. And after, again, many hundreds of hours of work, we now have the fantastic display horse that you can see, which again is a testament to the skills and dedication of our conservation team. That brings us to Farlap. One of the great things about an exhibition like this is that it enables us to uncover the hidden gems in our collection, and you'll see many of them down in the exhibition. This was a hidden gem that until about 5 weeks ago we didn't even know we had. It was that hidden. You've probably heard the story in the paper. Natalie Ison, who's one of the conservation team, was working on these two jars, which are among those that we'd selected for the central hub area of the exhibition. And she tipped it up, which we never do, really, because these, Farlap's heart is so fragile we can't really move it anywhere. The same applies to all of these other wet specimens. They are very old, and every movement causes tiny particles of the specimen to be dislodged, and they go into the solution. You can't attach a few atoms of flesh back together. So we don't move them very much. We rely on the cataloguing that came to us from the Australian Institute of Anatomy, which was, for its time, absolutely standard, but for our time, we expect a lot more information. These guys were labelled horse heart wall and horse organs various, which was a little bit vague, so Natalie was thrilled when she found that label on the bottom. She sent it through to me, because we were writing the text at the time, and said, here's some more information, we know what organs they are. And I think Kirsten and I looked at that photograph and thought, we sort of turned to each other and said, is there a part of the horse that in anatomical language is called the lap? And we didn't think there was. So Kirsten emailed an equine anatomist that we had some contact with, and he emailed back and said, well, no, there is no part called the lap. And these parts are... I guess we said, is it possible that these could be the kinds of anatomical material that could have been removed from the heart? And he confirmed that that was the case. Whereupon we did a little dance. So I guess since then we've been investigating further, both in the historical record, looking at the newspaper reports about the dissection that took place at the University of Sydney, which clearly indicates the scientists investigating the pericardium, which is that squished up membrane at the top of that jar, and their considerable interest in the state of and thickness of the heart wall. So that, combined with Natalie's work of taking the specimens out of the jar and reassembling the ventricle components into a triangle that seems to fit into the other heart specimen, means that, I guess, for now the evidence points strongly towards these being the missing pieces of the heart. So we're very thrilled to have found those. So I guess then the work, once we've chosen all the objects, the work begins on all the important things of deciding on the design, working through with the designer, positioning the objects, both big and small, in open display areas and showcases. And that the one of the big challenges for us in terms of the look of the show was really going to be, well, how do you do a horse exhibition without the horse's form being a major presence? And so just to end with, I'm going to take you through the story of how we did the mannequins. Through the course of researching the show, we'd come across the work of Harry Fasher, who's a significant sculptor, horse sculptor. She works in Oberon, and she her work really spoke to us about the dynamic, expressive form of the horse. And so we approached Harry initially to see if she could do a sculpture for us, or if we could borrow a sculpture from her. In the end, we asked her if she would go a step further, and that was to design a series of horse mannequins for the show. We knew we couldn't really use those fiberglass horse forms that you see outside of horse shops. They're not very expressive or dynamic. Perhaps more importantly, they don't reflect the many different kinds of horses that are represented in Australia and Australian life, and also in the exhibition itself. So, you know, a stock horse and a pony are very, very different animals. And in each case, the mannequins needed to truly be kind of what we've called elaborated object supports. So the Springfield Lando tack had very precise dimensions, and that needed to be met. So that the object needed to be the primary thing, and it needed to be supported, and each of those objects was the primary determinant of what the mannequins would be like. So here's Harry's work, the kind of work that Harry does that attracted us in the first place. And so then we began with the curatorial team briefing Harry on each of the individual horses. In most cases, we knew the specific horse we wanted to use. We knew Rookley Excalibur, we knew Marta Nicola, or else we knew the type of horse. We had a photograph of the precise horse that we were trying to represent. And so Jen and Nicole spent a lot of time gathering together information about those horses, and then Harry worked up a series of concept or sketches that showed the attitudes and basic forms of those horses. And then we measured all of the components, as I was just saying, to ensure that the form that Harry wove around the inside of those, I guess the spaces that they left, wouldn't stretch or hurt them. And then Harry made a maquette, so a small version of the of the sculpture for us to get started, so we knew that it roughly was in the right posture and would work with the objects. And this is the day she delivered the first one. I think we were all a bit gobsmacked the day that that happened. And this is that's the stock worker. That's Bruce's horse, isn't it? Harry had gone so far as to make tiny cardboard saddles and little bridles as well out of wire. So we knew where the contact points would be. So here are the maquettes for the Alpine stock worker and the first of the Landau horses. And then Thylacine Exhibition Preparation, who are out at Queanbeyan, had the job of turning those 1-in-6 maquettes into life-sized horse forms based on both measurements of similar types of horses and the measurements we'd taken from the horse tack itself. So there's Aaron working away on the first of those ones. So they're made in stainless steel and then later there's a rust paint applied to them. Here's Harry at work. Harry then came down and finessed them. So Harry works very instinctively, very organically with the shapes, and so she was able to sort of adjust and shift the horses in order to give them the kind of form that would be accurate to the eye of someone who knew horses really well. And so here's Harry and Nat, her assistant, I think, working away and cutting and welding and putting the horses together. And then here's Jen, and is it Chloe and Aaron, doing the work then of taking the stainless steel horse forms and fitting on the little tiny, tiny, now invisible pieces of wire and metal that support each of those individual pieces of tack, which Jen had been softened using humidity. Many of them had become somewhat stiff, so they had to be relaxed over a long period of time to be made supple enough to be fitted. And then they had to be sort of put onto the horses, and then we had to mark the specific contact points, and then Aaron had to weld on little tiny, tiny little pegs to hold the tack away from the metal form, because we didn't want the form and the tack to join together because there's a sort of chemical reaction that could hurt the object. So every single contact point had to be lifted up, but the supports had to be made invisible. And Jen, you told me the other day that it's somewhat harder and yet somewhat easier to put horse tack on a horse that doesn't, like, it's easier to put it on a real horse because the horse, you know, has a real form and has some muscle to work with, but it's easier to put this on because you can reach through the horse's stomach and pull something through, or through the head or something. So that piece of work was really major, and, you know, Jen really played a really significant role in bringing these to life. So here they are then. The tack was then attached to the vehicles to see how that worked, how that interface worked. And then everything was taken off, the horses were painted, and then eventually we had to come in and repeat that process again in the space of putting the tack on and attaching the vehicle. So that's been a really astonishing journey, I think, for us to get those happening. And so here's where we started and where we ended up. So here's Martin Nicola and Mary Wills Allen, and here they are. Here's the Martin Nicola in wire or in steel rod. Here's Brooke and Brooke Lee Excalibur running up the hill, and here they are in the gallery. And we did human mannequins too. So here's Constance Faithful in her riding habit and Constance the mannequin. So I just want to finish by showing a video of Harry at work. I think that really gives you a sense of how she does what she does. Here's Harry's workshop. And the video will come up pretty shortly. This is to show you how Harry made the central work, which is called Silent Conversation. There's the maquette for it. We've just got to get to the video. So we commissioned Harry to do a piece in the centre which allowed her that sort of more free expression to communicate the central idea of the exhibition, which really is the sort of bond and connection and communication between the human species and the equine species. So I'll just run the video for you, Amina. Oh, come on, mate. There we go. Just one more. And we can... The video's quite big. Work. Ken, is there? Is Ken there? Can't see Ken. He's disappeared into the black. Do I need to wait for the video to load? Is that basically what I've got to do? Okay. Where would that be? Yep. Oh, there it is. See, there we go. So we'll just watch Harry and then we'll finish up. Yeah, that's, what's Harry's dog name? Mate. Oh, did you click again?
I'm Harry Fasher, and I'm an artist. The sculpture Silent Conversation is about the relationship between horses and humans. Generally, I work with the horse as a representation of a human, so it's been quite challenging to work with it in this way, where there is actually a horse and a figure in one piece. The sculpture is about the quiet connection that we have with horses, the bond between horse and rider, the unique relationship between horse and man. The figure is a woman in the piece. We keep referring to it as the horse and man, but it's actually the horse and a woman. For this work, I started with the horse in full scale, in a very skeletal form, to work out my personal relationship with the horse. I then determined what the human figure was going to do. And in order to work out where the weight was and where its balance was, I built a small maquette of the human figure. So the actual making of the sculpture goes through several phases. There's the beginning, which is just the initial linear skeletal form. I then start bulking it out, building out the form, building up the shape of the legs, filling out the chest area. The head's always a bit problematic, how the head comes to fruition. I then spend a lot of time looking at the work. So a lot of time is spent walking around it, engaging with the sculpture. Nothing is fixed in stone. If something is incorrect, then you have to move it. That's where drawing comes in as a problem-solving exercise. Drawings to resolve where the weight is in the figure, where the muscular structure comes into the form. It's a battle of wills making a sculpture. Cutting, grinding, bending steel, so it's heavy work to begin with, or dirty work, like it's pretty intense work, working with steel. There's a point when you're making a sculpture which is, I suppose, about three quarters of the way along when you begin to see it. It starts coming to life, the forms start becoming real, and that's really exciting. That's what it's about. Suddenly you can see your imagination in real life. This linear line drawn method of building results in a real energy that you don't get with a solid mass. The horse appears to move as you walk around it. It has a life force. It has become my signature, these steel rod horses. And they're very much line drawings in space, three-dimensional drawings. I think that the physical form of the horse is innate. I think I don't think about it. I think I understand it. I work instinctively and intuitively to create these sculptures. It's my personal belief that our history with the Australian landscape is integral to who we've become and how Australia has got the identity that it has. And if this sculpture can represent that and convey the importance of our relationship with the horse and the landscape to generations in the future, I think that's a pretty special thing.
So that's a little film that Kirsten commissioned from Marg Hogan, who's a Bathurst-based filmmaker. It really says it all about that central sculpture, which has become such a pivot around which the rest of the exhibition rotates. I've talked a lot, and so I've run out of time. so what I basically, I guess, the work that followed those scenes that you've just seen is many weeks, Jen working long hours with registration and conservation and exhibitions, and many, many other people in the museum to take all of those different pieces of objects and video and graphics and text and shapes and forms and walls, and somehow magically over a sort of 5 to 6 week period bring them all together in the space into something that sort of works together as a single exhibition. So I guess I just again want to reiterate how grateful I am to all of those people, but also to all of you who come and bring it to life by coming and visiting. I might throw it open to questions and comments now. I think I've covered all of the things you wanted to look at, except for the High Country Brumbies question. But do you want me to talk about that a bit? So, not so much in this talk, but there, in the exhibition itself, I'm happy to take you down and have a bit of a look in there if you want to talk more about that, both the big video wall and then the objects and text that are there. Yeah. Any comments or observations or questions that I can answer, or Jen can answer, or Kirsten can answer, or Kelly can answer, or Heidi can answer, or any of us who've worked on the project can illuminate for you?
Is going to come to rest, not in the paddock where they'll be destroyed like the Zebra.
Yeah, so the question is what happens to all the mannequins and the sculpture after the exhibition's finished. The sculpture, we hope, will join the National Historical Collection, so it will become an object within our museum's collection. The mannequins have been built to be both specific ongoing mannequins for the horses represented in relation to each of those objects. You'll notice in the permanent galleries that we frequently have to show horse-drawn vehicles or harvesters and other things like that without the horses because there isn't enough room for us to do that most of the time. However, this time we've been able to show the horse in relationship to those. So each time we show the Mary Wills Allen sulky, we will have the opportunity to show it with a pony pulling it. The same with the Landau. So they'll be kept and put into our collection store. I think they're also, in some cases, versatile enough for us to be able to use them whenever we use, for example, I think Bruce's one and the Alpine stock worker should be versatile enough to mean that whenever we display some of our extensive saddle collections that we would be able to... they represent sort of stock horses, both Central Australian stock horses and Alpine stock horses, and so wherever those kinds of horses and the allied saddle and bridle are being displayed, we should be able to use those again with maybe minor modifications. So they'll be kept in the museum's store and brought out whenever we have future opportunities to display either those objects or similar kinds of objects. Yeah, we're pretty excited about them. Yeah. Any other thoughts or... Oh, good, I'm glad. Well, this is the best moment for us, really, when all of us in the museum team get to see what people feel about the exhibition, because it's very emotional. Thinking about if you've had a connection with a horse, I think it touches on very deep memories, and so we hope that those memories are brought forth by the exhibition. And there's lots of opportunities for you to tell us about those. If you hop on the exhibition website, if you've got a horse story to tell, we would love to hear it. So you can just type it in and it'll pop up on our My Horse Story page. It's true, yeah. I mean, who would have thought it? I mean, it really is quite amazing. Yeah. Is there any stuff on you found on eBay or Gumtree that didn't work out? Can you think of any, Jen? There's a few things we had to pass on. Yeah. Yeah. We had to be a little bit strategic because if we just kept going back to the acquisitions group and saying, oh, we've been shopping again, that wouldn't have gone down too well. I'm trying to think of anything. Yeah, as Jen says, it's never a simple process of sort of seeing something and then the next day asking for someone to sign the credit card. Objects have to pass very high thresholds of provenance and integrity and have a good story to really be coming into the frame for a show like this. So, yeah, it's, as Jen says, there's quite a bit of work that goes on. I mean, you see lots and lots of stuff goes through. Often fabulous objects have been very unsympathetically restored. So something that may have once, you know, had an astonishing original paint finish and someone's got out the paintbrush and painted away some of its history, and that's always a bit sad. But it's certainly something we have to keep our eyes on, yeah, to just check that there might be something amazing hanging out. You can see how the many amazing things we found, so, yeah. Yeah, you did. Yes, Heidi's right. By the time the word had got out that we were still looking for things, all of our colleagues and friends all across the museum were shooting us extra things that we should consider. So we're always grateful if people are eagle-eyed. I mean, in the old days it would have been people who went to clearing sales and stuff like that, but these days people can reach a much wider audience by putting it online. Any other thoughts or things you want to know about? You can always yarn to me or Jen or Kirsten if she comes back afterwards anyway, if you've got a burning question. So I guess it's just comes to me to wrap up and to thank you again for coming. Do visit the museum's horse-related website, which is nma.gov.au/horses. There's lots and lots of stuff there. Even, you know, curators can only ever say so many words on a tiny, tiny little label, so there's lots more behind-the-scenes stuff on the website and lots of opportunities for you to tell us your stories as part of a national conversation about horses in your lives, so please tell us more. And also please join us in a month's time on Thursday the 16th of October to hear Jennifer Wilson, curator at the National Museum, Tammy Van Denge of the RSPCA, and Karen Hood of Heavy Horse Heaven to talk about the long history of efforts to ensure the welfare of horses in Australia. So, thanks everyone.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.